Hello, everyone, and welcome from here in the capital city of Austin, Texas. This is Capital Geek, a podcast dedicated to the founders and operators that create the products we love and turn them into fabulous companies with meaningful exits. Whether you're raising your first round of capital or racing toward an IPO, this is where we deep dive on the lessons learned from seasoned industry veterans, geeks of all types, the experts leading product and engineering teams, operations and finance, or sales and marketing, and we'll both learn from their mistakes and celebrate their successes while providing a roadmap for you to accelerate your own journey toward success. My name is Josh Stevens, CTO at Elsewhere Partners, and I am the Capital Geek. In this episode, we'll talk with my friend and fellow geek, Kevin Gervais, co-founder and chief strategy officer at Statflow, a company that provides AI-driven technology to enhance personal communications through intelligent SMS capabilities. We'll talk with Kevin about the transitions that founders often make as their companies grow from early stage product invention through the accelerated growth of scaling up and all of the sleepless nights that come along with these changes and decisions. Kevin has led companies through both economic booms and economic busts and has a great perspective on how to thrive in both environments. So, without further ado, here's this week's episode of Capital Geek. Hello, everyone. Welcome to today's podcast. Today, we're meeting with Kevin Gervais from Statflow, based out of Canada. Kevin, welcome to today's show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
First time in Austin, Texas?
First time. I was going to bring a cowboy hat, but didn't fit in the...
We sell them right here locally, so you don't have to bring them from home if you don't like.
Oh, I'm going to hold you. I'm going to hold you to that.
Thank you very much for being on the show today and for coming down to chat with us. For those of you out there that don't know Kevin, Kevin Gervais is a serial entrepreneur and tech founder. He actually founded one of the companies we've invested in here at Elsewhere Partners called Statflow. Kevin, maybe we could start out with just giving us a little bit about your background and how you got started as an entrepreneur.
Well, my first SaaS business, I was getting subscriptions for a car wash, a company that my brother and I started called Sparkle and Shine. Started with just the area outside of our home, and then we got block after block. We were able to secure a four-block radius, which was my total addressable market at the time. And then market forces forced us to get into a different business. I've been an entrepreneur my whole life. Started doing web design when I was seven, mainly because Mac computers didn't have games, so I couldn't get myself into trouble. And then, I just got into working with different types of businesses and learned marketing from my grandfather, who was a sign painter for 63 years, and taught us how do you, make a sign so that way it actually gets noticed and read from a mile away. And back then, when they made signs, they would hand paint it. And so you really had to be careful how you would design it because you don't want to be going up in a scaffold and fixing it. And I had to be more in tune with what colors you should use and what the name should be. So he taught us how to do some of the marketing. But entrepreneurship is in our blood for my brother and I. And we've always just done business together.
You know, it's interesting, as I get to know you better, I notice that you have a lot of aptitude toward marketing. And that's something that we don't find very commonly in technical founders, gearheads like myself that are used to more dealing with code than people. And to find someone who is a product builder, a technologist, a coder, an engineer, who also has an aptitude and appetite to do marketing is pretty rare. Is that sort of how you got headed down the path of Statflow, sort of those two passions combined?
I would say I started with marketing because you have to build demand first. Or just as a kid, I would make flyers and build demand, and then I'd figure out how to build it. If I saw there was a need, I'd always want to try and solve it. And so it turned out that the easiest way to do it without a whole bunch of extra people and expensive equipment was to write code. And so that's what got me interested in learning how to technically build things so that I could solve problems. And it's kind of what happened with Statflow. So the guy I started Statflow with was one of my old clients. Came from the telecom industry, and he knew there was a problem that people in the industry had. And so I was curious. I didn't really know much about it, but I knew how to package stuff and a little bit how to build things. And And the more that I got into it, the more I realized that, yeah, there's a really big problem to solve. And it was fascinating to me. And it was a whole new world. So what drove me into building it out was just learning more and more about these people who needed help with their business.
And what time frame was that? And what was the problem that you were solving?
So we started the company back in 2012.
Okay.
And originally, yeah, what we worked on is not what we do today. Originally, we did something that was very different than what we do today. We would allow people who ran a certain type of stores, usually wireless stores, they could take data and upload it into our system and get reporting on what customers are about to leave them. And they were excited about that type of reporting because it allowed them to take action on it. But it was really simple business. It scaled pretty well. We kept it really lean. And we found out what they really wanted was to take the stuff that we put in those reports and have their team act on it, to call people, to follow up. And if we've given them a list of people who they're about to lose, they want to be able to try and stop that. And so then the business transitioned from there, and we ended up just obsessing over how do you actually solve the real problem of these
Which
these
is
folks.
Customer churn for these mobile carriers, right?
Well, at the time, I would say sure, but it even has evolved from there. Like, not only do they want to stop churn, but they wanted to grow their business. They wanted better alignment of their team. They had their staff turning over every 9 or 10 months. And so how do you deal with that? And how do you train them on how to contact customers? And they need a really easy way to do that. And we found out that over time, the way that they would have to contact customers to save them had to change as well. Originally they might have written a handwritten note or made a phone call, but today people don't answer the phone, right? They don't check voicemail. I know for sure I don't. I don't check voicemail at all. It caused us to just constantly think about what is the real way to solve this problem, knowing that that happens.
And so what time frame is this where this is happening, where you're converting from a tool that allows you to import a customer data list and based upon some analytics, go out and do some actions on your own, to a product that allows you to sort of build a workflow and conduct those actions from within the app itself?
Yeah, the first year we would take a CSV file and turn it into a report. After that, we started making a bit of a workflow for the frontline staff to be able to act on it. And that took us a couple of years to perfect how to actually get a young person in the frontline to do outreach and to want to do it and to have all the information they needed to do it well. And then around 2015, we saw that calling was not becoming as effective as it used to be. People were no longer answering their phones like they would. And probably that was because of robocalls and spam that was happening at the time, which we've seen now has really made it so people don't answer their phone almost at all. I know for me that's the case.
Oh, I never answer my phone. I get 100 spam calls a day and probably 20 or 30 spam text messages. So yeah. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. And the same thing that happened in email, where it just got flooded with spam and made it less effective, it's happening with phone and even text. So by 2016, we had to have a really great workflow for doing outreach over text and making sure that it was compliant. And there were a lot of factors to make sure that you did it well.
So this was a pretty interesting time to be in the world of mobile networks, right? You're selling to key cell phone providers. At the same time, there's the explosion of the Android world and the iPhone marketplace. While that's occurring, cell phone providers are buying satellite television providers. They're becoming internet providers. So suddenly, if I'm a cell phone company, I'm not just selling that monthly cell phone service. I'm selling equipment upgrades. I'm selling smart watches. I'm selling TV service. I'm selling internet broadband access.
Home security,
right? So that entire market landscape changed pretty dramatically while you guys were selling to them. And while you're, building a product that can now be able to handle workflows for secure compliant messaging, which hadn't really existed before, right? I mean, I can't remember when I got my first business text message from a provider, but it hasn't been that long ago. And even now, most of the messages I get are either personal or spam. There's very little commercialized enterprise-class SMS messaging going on.
Yeah, especially ones you can reply to, right? I get messages all the time from my carrier. who remain nameless, or I always will reply back and say, hey, actually, yeah, I'm really interested. I'd like to buy right now. And of course, you get no reply, or you'll get an automated response that says this cannot accept replies. And what marketers fail to realize is texting is a very personal medium where we expect a conversation. The reason why we check text is because we're having dialogues over it. Our friends are messaging us there. It's not about notifications. It's about conversations. And it's a different type of marketing that has to be protected. And otherwise, you're going to see the same thing happen to texting that we saw with emails and phone calls. It'll get abused. And then what's left for marketers, right? We'll go back to mail again.
You know, it's interesting that the traction you're seeing in the marketplace is for any market where there's this need for a seller to have a direct communication with an end user. And I think you're right that what I've seen, at least as a buyer and a practitioner giving strategy advice, is that we don't want to answer via email or phone anymore. When I have a choice, I will always choose Slack over almost every other medium of communication in a business environment. Yet when I need to reach someone that's away from their desk or not inside one of my Slack channels, text messaging is pretty much the closest thing I have.
Yeah. And at scale, you know, businesses need to make sure that that is done with the right wording, especially when you're trying to talk to consumers, right? Like consumers or people who are, out of the office, they're not in your Slack channel.
Right.
And so how do you make sure you can reach them? How do you make sure you can get a reply from them? And also, how do you make sure it's good quality and that you have the right to contact them? So we're seeing that for businesses to use texting effectively, it has to take in a whole bunch of factors. And with my role now, I'm able to spend time thinking about all the different factors that come into making business messaging effective, which is, not just that it's legal, but what should it sound like? Mm-hmm. When you send a link to somebody to do something over text, let's say you text somebody with a link to sign something, are you sending them to a page that actually looks great on mobile, right? And there's going to be a need for standards for how that medium can be used in a business setting. And so we see that being really universal that, not only is it about, using that channel of communication, but how do you protect it? How do you make it high quality? And how do you make the experience better than what it was previously?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And also what we've seen in the marketplace is that forward-thinking, aggressive salespeople are already using text. They're going to find a way to get their deals done every quarter. And so finding a way to do this in a centrally managed, compliant way, as opposed to having your sales reps texting from their own personal phones to your customers, is probably a much better way of going about it. You took us through 2016. So, you started as an inventor and tech entrepreneur. You're now a founder and entrepreneur building products. Sometime around 2016, you decide to go out and get some funding and accelerate the business. Walk us through sort of that decision and what was going through your head.
Our first capital raise was a small round in early 2015, which was like an angel round. And that was the first time I ever raised capital in my life. And it was super scary. And had all this pressure that maybe I put on myself, but I thought, I cared so much about not screwing this up. I thought, okay, these people have trusted me to get a return on this. I have a huge sense of duty on this. And so I felt terrified once we did actually get the money. You'd think there'd be the sense of relief, but it was like, I've got to execute. And then we were able to see some good growth. And we closed our first kind of larger seed round, around $2 million in early 2016. And that's when things started to really have to get professionalized. We had to form a board that was more formal. We had reporting requirements. I had to have investor management. We had, dozens of investors at that point. And so I had to send out regular updates, and I've never done that before, so I had to learn that. And that was, it was a new experience. The benefit of it is over time, I just, you know, I had to keep asking for help. That was probably the biggest learning from that, is just constantly ask different investors and ones like, how do I do this and not screw it up? Lots of Googling. But through that phase, was able to see that regular communication allowed investors and the board to be a help.
Yeah.
To be a guide. And 2016, we also dealt with a whole bunch of custom work we had to do for one of our clients. And, you know, it was a time where we were still trying to figure out product market fit and whether we were onto something, even with the messaging side. The market wasn't really ready for, you know, messaging to be used for outreach. Then we started to see some traction in late 2016 on that piece. Yeah, 2017 became a bigger year of growth, and we went north of 50 people. And then you go through a whole other change, right? So there's that phase when you first take capital, you're learning how to deal with that dynamic.
Yeah, of having investors and people to answer to and
right.
reporting.
I'd never had a boss in my life.
Yeah.
And I've always started different businesses with my brother. We've always been the ones in charge. And all of a sudden now I had bosses. But that, I think that was my mentality, right? I thought, oh, dear, like, you know, yeah, they're telling me what to do. But once I started to see them more as partners made sure that I was communicating regularly with them, then they definitely were there to help, right? It wasn't them breathing down my neck. And as a investor in the company, I saw that by doing some of the things that were suggested, professionalizing elements of the business that I otherwise wouldn't have cared about, it allowed us to grow the valuation of the company. And so selfishly for myself as a shareholder, it improved the value of the company there. So, but yeah, going through that phase was definitely new.
What were some of the key sort of aspects of the business that had to mature during that phase, or some key help that you might have brought in to help?
In 2015, one of the first hires we brought in, we were about 15 people at the time, was HR. So we started to really work on our internal processes. In 2016, we had to continue to do that. There were new laws that came out in Ontario around labor laws and safety. And once you get to a certain size, if you get to 20, 25 people, you have fire wardens you have to have. There's different safety checks you have to have, different documentation from labor code that you have to adhere to. And how do you deal with various HR issues that are raised, and what are you allowed to say as a manager and not allowed to say? So like 2016 was a lot of learning around scale. Like when you're broke fast, you're going to make a bunch of mistakes. Sometimes you make mistakes in hiring and then you don't figure that out till later. And so you're dealing with situations that you didn't really have to deal with when it was a small group that grew very, you know, grew at your own pace, where you could really handpick the people and take your time with the hiring. When you're growing fast, sometimes you're going to make those mistakes. And so dealing with the fallout of that, and also getting better at finding what it was you needed out of the next hires, like the mentality or the skill set or the drive, et cetera, that was the learning. And in 2017, we grew fast. We were using cash, you know, pretty well, but that would have been the time for us to double down on bringing in a new finance lead. And it wasn't apparent until later that we should have
done that sooner. Yeah.
And I didn't realize that until, you know, much later that, oh yeah, like that would have been the time. So I think what would have made the transition easier to having investors is having strong financial management that is more than just bookkeeping, right? It's being able to put a forecast together and being able to make it have all the assumptions in place. And realizing that I couldn't do it all.
Well, I think as I deal with, you know, portfolio companies outside of Statflow within other parts of the portfolio, and really just companies throughout the world that we worked with, that's a pretty common lesson learned, you know, to bring on some expert level CFO type help early on. And I would say universally that no matter how early you bring it on, people generally say they wish they would have done it sooner. Unless that's the first hire they make. Because, you know, once you start working through the reporting structures of having some sort of a venture capital player within the mix, and you're thinking through growth and how that will change over time, you know, that can be really burdensome on you as a founder, especially when you're a technical founder who probably has other things that could be consuming your time, maybe in a more meaningful way.
I think one of the biggest lessons is the first time we took, or I think one of the biggest lessons was that when you first take money and form a first board, who's on the board and who's at the table really matters. When you have a board that's just pure finance, it's not as useful as having operational help. And we grew the fastest when we were surrounded by people who were operators. I guess the lesson learned is who's on the board really matters, and having operator experience there can be a huge help. People who've been there, done that, scaled, been through gritty issues, and that can really be a strong resource.
Well, one thing that you've echoed throughout the day, not just on this podcast, but when we were speaking earlier, was that, you know, one thing you find to be a way to accelerate the business is to bring on people who have been there and done that before. You know, find people who have already faced that challenge and solved it themselves. And, you know, that's one of the things I find to be a common thread amongst high-performing founders and operating teams, is that they're willing to reach out to the network and get advice from other operators who have done that before.
Yeah.
And that's part of what we do at Elsewhere. We try to put at least two or three, you know, operators within the mix with each portfolio company to help them with their strategy and to help operationalize things over time. But I think it all starts with the founding team having an attitude that makes it, you know, amenable to them to have that outside help, to go out and find someone who solved the problem before, because chances are someone has been through this exact problem in the past and their expertise can move you forward very rapidly.
My personal mantra is that whatever I know today is obsolete tomorrow. Even if I've done a whole bunch of analysis and I've written everything out, it still can be obsolete tomorrow. And so when I think that way, it allows me to be open to get advice and say, okay, if that were true and you know things can change, or who can I lean on to help me through thinking about the problems I'm dealing with, or who's done this before? Maybe not this exact thing, but who's gone through this type of situation before? What I found is most mentors have not gone through the exact same situation before, but they can go through the feelings. They can go through their process of how they dealt with it. And what I've seen, too, is that there's always a number of people out there that you can call, you can reach out to. They're just a tweet away or just a LinkedIn message away. And most people are welcome to give advice if you actually are not trying to pitch them on something but actually need help.
So, you know, you went through an interesting transition where after you'd founded the company and began growing it, you went out and got funding, you decided to move over into a chief strategy role and focus on company strategy and bring on a CEO to focus on day-to-day operations. Walk us through sort of that decision, you know, how you think about that, what it was like for you to go from never having a boss before to sort of naming your boss, right, to step over, and then now being able to step back and focus wholly on strategy and long-term vision for the company.
Yeah, that was not an easy one. I think once we raised the funding in 2018, I realized my job had to change. I had to be the steady hand that had regular meetings with everybody. I had to have a pulse on things and be consistent. And for me, what I'm passionate about is what's happening next. These are the trends. These are, you know, the problems that we should solve. I've just been, you know, I heard this problem from somebody today and I, you know, in a conversation I had, and oh, maybe we should, you know, investigate that. By having to be the person doing all of the touch points with people every week and having a pulse on all the gritty details in HR, et cetera, I found I couldn't do the stuff that I really was excited about and that I love to do. And, you know, and in fact, I wish I had done it sooner. I wish I had done it a year prior, because that would have been the time. Like, once we started hitting a good stride in growth, that should have been the time to bring in, you know, some good resources, because then I wouldn't have put myself in a situation where, you know, I had to, like, suffer through some of the boring stuff, necessary, but for me, boring stuff. It would have been I would have enjoyed it more.
You know, I think it's interesting as we mature in our careers, there's a point that most of us reach where we realize that the things that we enjoy doing happen to also be the things that we're naturally very good at. And I think it's a natural quality for most people as they continue to work up the ladder and as an entrepreneur to grow bigger companies, that you would logically assume that that would include your role continuing to be in that, you know, head cook and bottle washer role, as they say. But I think what's key is that, you know, you realized it wasn't where your passion was. It wasn't making you that happy. And, you know, as a strategist myself, I know what that's like to be in that kind of role where you can see years down the plan and years away from the roadmap, but it takes a long time to execute those things and a lot of detail and a lot of day-to-day operational acumen that strategists usually don't find a lot of joy in enforcing.
Yeah. And since moving over, I mean, this is probably my perfect job. You know, I'm able to spend time with customers, with prospects, with partners. I can think about new ideas. I can validate ideas. You know, if someone has, you know, thinks that there's a need for something, I can check to see that that's the case and investigate it. And it's been great change. And I can do it as well without having to hurt my health or hurt, you know, my mental health as well. Because I found that I was wired as somebody that when I had to do the same thing every week, day in and day out, run that certain management meeting every day, every week, and follow a certain process every week, it just caused me pain. Like, yeah. It's like my kryptonite. So, but you know, you remove that need, and now I'm free to be able to kind of go in whatever direction can drive the most value for the company and for me selfishly as a shareholder.
It's super interesting right now because you've taken this company from a concept, you know, 8 years ago, and a pretty basic, you know, product that you would go to a web service and import a CSV file and get actionable intelligence from it. You've walked us through some of the exciting changes that have occurred at Statflow over the last few years. But I must say that the future looks super bright, at least from my perspective. Maybe you could talk a little bit about sort of where you're headed next.
Well, me stepping away from the day-to-day has allowed me to look beyond and say, where are the macro trends? What are the big rocks, big problems that every business is going to run into? Not just now, but in the future. Right now, every business struggles to reach customers, right? We're doing email campaigns or maybe there's text blasts they're sending, but it's becoming less and less effective. Marketing is harder and harder to get people to do things. And what we've figured out is if you actually activate, you know, people who work within a business to have a real conversation, a human conversation with customers or prospects, but it's consistent, you can maintain great response rates and conversion rates. It doesn't get worse over time. Especially if it's the right words and it's high quality and it's the right time and you're targeting the right people. And so I see a world where every business can have a messaging first customer journey where every interaction with a customer is over messaging, but it's a dialogue and it's mobile first. You're sending links to things to get signed. You're conducting business over text. It's not about sending a marketing message, but you're actually able to have transactions and relationships and get meaning from a customer over text. And that, I think that's the more human side of marketing. And it's a new channel, right? I think texting we have not cracked yet as marketers in the way that consumers want, right? We want it to be a conversation, but we want it to be great quality. And so I see a world where we can enable that based upon what we've learned in working in highly regulated markets, and especially, you know, how do you make sure that every message is done in a legally compliant way or according to a high standard of communication? And so, yeah, that's what we're working on for the next, you know, foreseeable future is taking what we've done in markets like telecom and wireless stores and making that available to every business that wants to have consistency in the way they communicate, have a great customer journey that actually reaches people instead of it being an email message that goes into a spam filter. and how can you actually break through the noise?
Well, as a technologist and a consumer, I hope you get there quickly, because there are many aspects of my life where the idea of calling the companies I do business with and dealing with the different on-hold, you know, routing algorithms and potentially a call center in some country where they don't even speak my language natively, it's horrible, right? Yeah. And if there was some easy way to do my business with those vendors via text message and get an answer back, I would sign up right away.
Well, and the reason why that happens is the existing tools to enable that type of experience require massive transformations on the business's side to support. And there's a better way where you can implement these things in a lean way that sits on top of whatever you have as a business. And ideally, it can sit on top of whatever staff member you have. So it's not even just people sitting in a call center that can do it. I think that's the opportunity, is unlocking, you know, the systems and the people that a business already has, but being able to use that to delight customers over this channel. Like I found even last week, I was trying to change a reservation for a restaurant, and I had to call them. And like there was this like 5-minute process. And I thought, just interactions like that, I thought, I wish I could just text them.
Yeah, and say, I'm going to be 15 minutes late, and, you know, move my reservation.
Yeah. It doesn't even have to be in regulated markets, but every business, I think, is going to be faced over the next 12 months with this realization that consumers expect this type of experience. They will only eventually go to places that offer this type of experience. And they've got to change. But it's going to touch everybody, every single business in every industry.
Well, thank you very much for coming down to speak with us, Kevin. I've really enjoyed the conversation and look forward to having you back again.
All right. Thanks for having me.
That's it, everyone, and thank you for joining Capital Geek. Subscribe via Apple, Stitcher, or any platform where you usually find fantastic podcasts. Tune in again soon for another great episode of Capital Geek.